glad you're here. It's going to be a great day. Did you know that this is a thing?
What did we talk about that was that?
That made me feel all the feels.
There is a group hug coming here in just a minute.
That's amazing.
Welcome to The Lisa Show. I'm Richie T. Thank you so much for listening. Coming up this hour, did you know that you can replace eggs with applesauce in your recipes? We're going to tell you about more substitutions that maybe you didn't know about. Then we're going to find out if pepper spray is enough to help you defend yourself. Coming up in your morning buzz, I want you to check out a video that's trending on YouTube today, but not for the video, for the comments. And I'll tell you what that video is coming up in 15 short minutes. On Wednesdays on The Lisa Show, we like to celebrate those small wins, those big wins, or maybe there's just a unique win that's happened in your life or in the life surrounding you. We call it your everyday rock star.
The Lisa Show's Everyday Rock Star.
Have you ever wondered what happens to research animals when the research is done? Well, one biology professor at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay has been helping intelligent lab rats retire to good homes for the past 20 years. His name is Richard Hine, and he joins us today as our everyday rock star. Welcome, Rick.
Well, thank you very much.
Now, is the program actually called Adopt a Rat?
Yeah, that's what I've coined it. And it's an effort to get students and community members interested in providing good homes for our research animals.
So walk us back that 20 years ago when you found and saw this need and then thought of these little four-legged creatures.
Yep. So when I first began teaching at University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, I teach the freshman and sophomore biology courses, and I know it's really important to get students actually doing science. And one of the projects that I wanted them to work with are live animal models. But part of working with live animals like intelligent rats is to use them very responsibly. And that's one of the things that I wanted to teach my students. So at the end of the experimentation, at the end of the academic year, part of that responsibility extends to finding them good homes to live out their lives after the work the students do with them.
But they're rats. Do people have some resistance towards that?
Some do, and that's one of the other really important benefits of introducing students to working with live animals is many of them don't have that experience growing up. So many of them come in really nervous about working with the animals, but they realize that they're very social, very intelligent, and just wonderful animals to work with. And usually about half the rats that we work with go to the students that actually work with them.
So I have to just marvel at this thing, something that probably would have been neglected or not even a second thought to a lot of folks. You have not only been able to find great homes for these rats, but also you're saying this is a tremendously educational experience.
Oh, for sure. And it's one of the rare places, I think, that students actually get this opportunity really early in their career. So my goal is to provide my students with this experience. And it is a lot of work working with animals.
Sure.
There are a number of protocols you have to go through. You need approval through the institution. There's oversight by federal groups. So a lot of people opt not to do that until students get further along in their careers. But to me, that effort's really worth it to get students coming in as freshmen and sophomores really engaged in doing the work.
We have about a minute left in the time that we have with you. And I guess I would just ask, is there a particular student that this program has benefited or something that it has benefited you that maybe you didn't see coming as you began this program?
Yeah, I don't have any specific examples, but I do have multiple students that contact me later on in time. And usually it's about when I'm running the Adopt-A-Rat program. They see something on social media and they get back in touch with me and they say, hey, I just wanted to let you know that that experience really was a career changer for me. And many of them have gone on in healthcare fields, in research, and graduate school even. And many of them point to these really high impact experiences working in the laboratory, open-ended experiments with animals, as one of the real highlights of their undergraduate career.
Making a huge difference in students' lives and certainly in the lives of those rats. I can't even believe I'm saying it, an Adopt-A-Rat program. Rick Hine, you are our everyday rock star. If you know someone in your life that you want to nominate to be that everyday rock star, you can send us those everyday rock star moments or nominations to thelisashow@byu.edu. You might notice that the Lisa Show sounds a little bit different today. That is because, well, there's not a Lisa here. So if you weren't able to listen to yesterday's Lisa Show or you don't follow us on social media, I encourage you both to go back and listen to yesterday's show and to follow us on social media. But we shared with you that Lisa's husband, who over 4 years ago was diagnosed with ALS, he passed away over the weekend. We've had many listeners who have reached out and who have wanted to share messages of hope and of healing with Lisa, and we invite you to do that if you find us on Facebook. It's The Lisa Show. That's where we're directing people to it. Our email address, thelisashow@byu.edu, is another great resource if you would like to send Lisa a message. We're certainly respecting her privacy as she takes this time to be with her family and want to give her as much possible time to be able to be with them. She feels all of the prayers that are being said for her family. And having the opportunity to message with her, she's excited to be back with the show at an appropriate time, and that will happen in the future. I know there have been some people that have said, well, she's coming back, right? And yes, I will affirm to you that she will be back, but after she's taken the time necessary to grieve and to take care of her family. If you would like to send a message to her, again, you can find The Lisa Show on Facebook. Also, our email address, thelisashow@byu.edu. We knew that there was the potential that this would happen at some point. So Lisa and I, beforehand, we got together and we recorded a lot of interviews that we felt like were really great, that we wanted to share with you. And this is one of those interviews.
Moving with kids can be a nightmare or it could be a really fun adventure. But what is it that draws that dividing line between a month of meltdowns and a fresh new start? Well, here to help us with this question of moving with kids is clinical psychologist, parenting expert, and founder of AHA Parenting, Dr. Laura Markham. Welcome, Dr. Laura.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
So, okay, we have this situation. We need to move. And it can be hard, I think, first of all, just to break the news to our kids. What's the best way to do that?
Well, when you announce it, first of all, you're going to be excited, right? I mean,
yeah,
you're moving for a new job or to be close to your parents or because you've always wanted to live in a specific place or whatever. Your child doesn't have any of that. Even if they love their grandparents, they're attached to where they live now. Even if you'll have a home, a house, and you right now have a small apartment, it doesn't matter. Your child is where they are now. That's what they love. They are not going to take well to your announcement. So you should know that going in, because that way you're prepared if your child reacts with anger or sadness or just complete bafflement. Why? But why, Mom? Can my best friend come too? You know, they're not going to understand. So I think we need to know that going in, and we need to listen to their feelings. And that doesn't mean that we are going to change anything. And we acknowledge, you know, yeah, this does mean you're going to be going to a new school. I know that's a big change. I know you'll miss your old school. I know you'll miss your friends. It's true. And you'll make new friends. And you will end up loving your school. We drove by it, and we saw the playground was really great or whatever. But don't try to talk them out of their feelings.
Mm-hmm. How soon before we move should we tell them?
Seconds.
As soon as we're considering it, as soon as it's a done deal,
no,
2 weeks.
Not when you're considering it. Yeah. Not when you're considering it, because considering it, things could not happen. You might not move in the end, right?
Right.
So, no, once you've actually decided, yes, we're taking that job, yes, we're buying that apartment or house or whatever has moved you from considering to a decision.
Now, Lisa,
and at that point, then you absolutely would want to discuss it before they hear you talk to someone else about it. If they hear you on the phone saying, oh, well, when we move to X place, your child's going to be like, wait a minute.
Wait a second.
Right.
Is this something that you had to do, Lisa, or were you always raised in the same home?
So I moved into my childhood home when I was 2. I barely remember it. And my parents lived there for 30 years.
And then you've been in your home now. Your kids have been in the same home, right?
For 16 years. Yeah.
So I come from a household where I don't know if it was mom got fickle every about 3 years, but we would constantly be on the move. And I can remember her employing some of these tactics, being like, you know what, we will be able to come and visit this neighborhood. We never moved super far from, you know, house to house, but very intentionally, she would have a one-on-one and also a familial discussion where she would address, you know what, it's all right that you feel this way. I'm going to miss these things too. And I really think that permission that she gave us to say, oh, this is sad or this is hard, really, and it seems counterintuitive, made it easier.
Yes, because what we find with emotions is when we try to talk someone out of their emotions, they tend to hang on to them harder.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when we accept those emotions, and we say, yeah, I understand how you feel, then the person doesn't have to hang on to them so hard. Those, as with all emotions, they can change and evolve.
Right. How does this conversation change when you're talking about different ages? So some kids may be too young to even really understand, you know, what's going on, and then younger kids, older kids, teenagers. How do you adapt?
I think the general rule of thumb is true across the board that to the degree they understand they're moving, you want to listen and empathize. But with little tiny kids, like you were 2 when you moved,
mm-hmm.
you know, they're not going to have any idea what you're talking about.
Right.
So acting it out with stuffed animals helps. That you actually do a little like a puppet show for your child with stuffed animals. And you say, oh, here's where we sleep. Here's the bed. And then you put a bed like across, you know, into a different room of your home and say, we're moving now, let's take all our things. And, you know, the stuffed animals gather everything up and move, you know, to the other room, and their bed comes too, right? If you can do something like that, it can really help kids.
Mm.
But really with a 2-year-old, that day, that night, even when they're in their old bed in their new room, they're going to cry because they want to go home.
Right.
And you know what? The good news is they will get over it more quickly than older kids will. So you just at the time you say, I know you miss our old house. Now we're in our new house. So that you give them some language, even if they're not even that verbal. They'll understand. The receptive language is ahead of the expressive. So they'll understand at least a little bit.
You've written a lot about this, about the importance of honoring their grief. And I appreciate that you phrased it that way instead of just saying let them, you know, feel their feelings. But it's honoring their grief. Can you tell me a little bit more about what that looks like?
Yeah, you have to get some closure on the attachments to where they are now. Their friends, their teachers, their house, their backyard. And you can do that in a couple of different ways. One is to write goodbye notes and thank you notes that they write to people. And one is to talk about the things you've loved, about where you are leaving. And be sure to do a goodbye walkthrough of your house so that they can, you know, go room to room and share the things that they loved about being in that house. Be sure that you exchange addresses with people. Take photographs of your child with, you know, at their old favorite playground, with their best friend, anybody who's been important to them, the local bakery where they always go in. you know, take a picture of them in that bakery, just so that they have that. It's not like it just disappears,
right?
It's still there in their heart.
Like it didn't matter.
This way, there's a record. Yeah.
We're talking with Laura Markham about moving with kids, and a lot of what we've talked about really seems to be those younger kids focused. I think about the situation that my wife had. She moved the summer between her junior and senior year of high school, which to me just sounds miserable, but it was life-altering for her. She was very involved, you know, had her friend group already established, was involved in sports, but because of a job, you know, their family had to move from the state of Louisiana to the state of Utah, and it was a completely different life, essentially. That I think is a very hard thing to overcome, but for just teenagers in general, where so much of their life is outside of the home, how can we minimize that, you know, almost destruction that is moving?
And to them, it is destruction. They will feel you've ruined their life.
Yeah.
And I also have confidence that they will be able to put a new life together. I've heard from parents, you know, our 13-year-old refused to move, and of course, they did move with her, and then somehow they had to go back to their old town a year later. And she was irate when they had to move back because she liked her new life better, actually, and she'd put down roots there, and she didn't want to go back. So they do put down new roots, and they do make it work, but I think it's important not to minimize the feelings they have.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you say your wife had to move, you're right. Between junior and senior year is a terrible time to move a kid, and they're going to have a lot of feelings about it. So you want to acknowledge that. I think also you want to give them as much control as you can, because one of the things that happens is they feel like, well, I'm just being pushed around here. What I want doesn't matter, and I have no control over this. And that feels pretty terrible. So as much as possible, give them the ability to make decisions about anything in the new place that you can, and also make sure that they have the opportunity to go back and visit. You know, a kid who's a teenager can usually, if you're going all the way across country, it can be hard. But even then, what's wrong with them going back and, you know, getting on an airplane and having a visit back to their old town to stay in touch with people? What they'll find, unfortunately, is that life has moved on without them. And they're more left out, and they're feeling, they'll realize when they come home, you know, let's say this is 3 months after they've moved in, it's summer vacation or something, they'll realize, wow, you know, life has moved on, and I actually am starting to feel comfortable in my new place. And that's sad, but a good thing. So it's just all part of the process of coming to terms with a big change.
So once the family has moved and you've dealt with that grief in the best way that you can, how can parents help get their kids to be excited about the new place and to learn how to love it right from the get-go?
Well, put some attention into family life and family connecting into the community, and find things that they love to do there. You know, where's the best pizza? You know, where's the best playground? Go to the library, get them a library card, start getting out books regularly. Give them a way to connect with other children in whatever way you can. If it's in the summertime, you might be enrolling them in some sort of a day camp or even a class, just so that they can meet other kids and feel connected. And, you know, it's so often when we've moved for a job, we're working really hard at that job. So it's important to remember that the kids are not doing that, and they need you, the parents, to be involved with them in putting down roots in the new community. So going for walks in the neighborhood, finding the things that you all want to do together in, you know, just, you know, if there's a children's museum, whatever things they might enjoy doing, try to do with them so they feel like, oh, this place I live, this community is a great place to live, and I feel connected and I enjoy being here. And of course, your home, you'll also want to work together on making your home a convivial space that everyone loves being in.
Is this something that you're an expert on because it was thrust upon you or because you've thrust it upon your own children?
Well, I think both. I get this question a lot from parents, so I've thought about it a lot. Mm-hmm. I also had the experience of moving my kids, and my son was very attached to a best friend, and we moved, and then 3 years later, so he was 4 years old, mm-hmm. 4 and a half, and then we moved again 3 years later. We had moved west. We moved from New Jersey to Michigan, and then we went back from Michigan to New York 3 years later, and he lost another best friend. And he didn't act out, I would say, but it was not an easy thing for him to make that transition. And so we worked hard to help him to process that, made a book in advance about what the move would be like, and tried to facilitate his connection with his friend. But I'll tell you, a 7.5-year-old boy, you know, it doesn't last that long, long distance. And it is hard for them to know even how to connect with each other. And I've learned a lot more over the years. And if I had a child today who was that young and went through this again, I think I'd be better at finding ways for them to stay in touch and to do more visiting. Hmm. Because I think it's an important process for them to, as I say, to get some closure, to work through their feelings on. But the book is helpful. Making a book about the upcoming move with a happy ending, right, of all the things you're looking forward to in your new place, that's a really important thing to do.
Yeah. So someone maybe is thinking, okay, I'm getting ready to talk to my kids about this big move coming up. I want it to go as smoothly as possible. What is your best piece of advice for that person who is feeling a little bit worried?
Before they talk to their children?
Yeah.
I think it would be that we have moved kids for forever. We've moved kids when we need to, and the kids do adapt, and they do fine. And if kids have enough support, they can adapt to anything. And so the question really is, I would empower the parent. I would want the parent mm-hmm. to know you can make this work, and you can even make it good for your kids. And the difference is how much support you give your kids.
Dr. Laura Markham is a clinical psychologist, a parenting expert. She's written 3 books on how to become a peaceful parent to have happier kids. You can find all of her advice online at ahaparenting.com.
Coming up, do you feel unsafe when going for a run? We're going to give you some tips for protecting yourself from predators. And coming up in your morning buzz, let's all watch the video. Actually, you don't even need to watch the video. Let's talk about the comments. I'll tell you what video that is coming back right after this. Thank you for listening to The Lisa Show. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Lisa Show. Later this hour, have you ever wondered what your dog thinks of you? I hope I know what Robert, my poodle, thinks of me, but I have wondered what he's thinking. Well, we're going to tell you how you can find out just exactly what your four-legged friend is thinking. But first, we got your morning buzz. It's 3 stories that are trending online right now, things that people are talking about, and I have gathered them for you. I put them in my little morning buzz basket. It's lined with gingham. Now let me take it out of the basket and share them with you. This first one, today is National Herb and Spice Day. Probably not something you're going to see a bunch of on social media, although let's make the challenge. Take a photo, maybe a selfie even, of your favorite spice. Share it up on social media. You're a cumin fan? Paprika? I'm not biased. Maybe you want to try something that you've never cooked with before. You can bring that into the kitchen today. It is National Herb and Spice Day. Let's share it on social media. Let's flood social media with herbs and spices. Now I'm thinking about KFC. This from the CDC. At least 28 states are not following the guidelines on reporting new COVID-19 cases. Half of the 28 states, saw the trend of new cases increasing in the last week. The states are not reporting probable cases. That's what they say. Those are cases that show evidence of an infection without the confirmation of a lab test, and cases where coronavirus was listed as a cause or contributing cause of death,
but also are not confirmed with a lab test. Some of the states with the largest populations, like California, Florida, New York, and Texas, are among those listed as not reporting probable cases. And as I mentioned, a lot of states are showing those uptick in cases. Arizona could, in fact, have to re-shut down because of the increase of cases that they've had there. So be careful. Continue to wash your hands. We're not through this. Wear a mask. Be socially distant. Be socially responsible as we make our way through the coronavirus pandemic. And then finally this. I saw that this was trending, and I was meh interested. It's a PS5. That is PlayStation 5 trailer for the future of gaming. That's what the title of this video is. It's essentially a sales piece for the PlayStation 5, and you're thinking, okay, you know, I'm not much of a gamer. What could this actually have as an appeal for me? Well, read the comments. People are hilarious about the comments. Maybe it's my 2020 humor. Maybe it's just I was looking for a laugh and found it in a place that I didn't expect it. But PlayStation 5, the future of gaming. Come for the comments. Don't bother with the video. That's your morning buzz. Here on The Lisa Show, we like to talk about a lot of things. And here in this next segment, I want to talk about something very important. We like to give you the tools that you need to live your best life. But let's also live a safe life. Safety first is something that you might hear us say. According to the U.S. Bureau of Justice, just over 650,000 women were victims to rape or sexual assault in 2018. That's 300,000 more women than the year before. Every time a woman walks down a street alone, in the dark, her mind races with all the worst possible case scenarios. So we want to help you get rid of that fear and replace it with confidence. Here to teach us more about the tools and knowledge that we need to be prepared for potential life-threatening situations is Karen Stastny. She's the Marketing Director for Communications for Damsel in Defense, a company whose goal it is to help women protect themselves in dangerous situations. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning.
So certainly, as I share those statistics, I had to stop, go back and read that one more time. Those statistics are staggering.
They are. They are. So, you know, 1 in 5 women are survivors of rape. That's ridiculous. The numbers are ridiculous. A violent crime occurs every 26 seconds. And 1 in 3 women experience domestic violence. The numbers are huge. So it is clearly an issue.
I think the key to a lot of our discussion, really, that basic first step is just awareness. Why is it important that we're aware that it's occurring? And then how does awareness translate into helping us be more confident?
Well, you know, the biggest market, sadly, I hate to say the word market, but it's true, or group of people who are affected, especially with assault and rape, are our college-age student girls. And sadly, at that age, we feel invincible. You know, we feel like nothing can harm us. And so what we like to teach is situational awareness. And it's just what the name says, is being aware of your situation. It's being aware of your surroundings. And you see a lot of people, if you go outside, people walking down the street, what are they doing? Their heads are down. They're in their phones. They're not looking around. People, when they're out exercising, they've got headphones in, even if they're walking the dogs. Headphones in, music up loud. We like to do that. That's pretty normal.
Sure.
But in both of those scenarios, you just cannot be aware of your surroundings. So a lot of the training that we do focuses around being aware of your surroundings, the people, where you're at, the buildings, the parked cars, the cars driving by, kind of head on a swivel. Mm-hmm. It kind of helps you ascertain what's going on. For me, you know, I'm always looking, gosh, if something happened here, that would be a good escape route, you know, where I can get out of a situation. It's not maybe the cool thing to do, but it's the safe thing to do. So the other thing we teach is that we all have a built-in self-defense system.
Okay.
And we should never discount it. It's our intuition or our gut instinct, whatever you want to call it. But if something feels off, it probably is. If someone's giving you a bad vibe or a bad feeling, you're probably spot on. But we can't not act because we're embarrassed or out of apathy. We need to listen to our gut instinct and follow it. So that's That's the biggest thing. Situational awareness and intuition is our first line of defense.
And I want to speak to each of those for a quick second. Let's break down the difference of maybe situational awareness and fear, because I know what you're not saying is that we should be constantly looking around and be afraid of who might be behind that car or what might happen next. So how do we delineate those two things?
So, you know, living in fear actually makes us less situationally aware, because then we're fearful of everything.
Right.
You know, it's hard to delineate between what is really a threat and what am I just feeling fearful all the time. But if you're aware of your surroundings, just aware of what's going around you, your gut instinct is going to tell you when something's off. And if you can be empowered and confident, you know, people, it's the difference between a soft target and a hard target. If I'm a hard target, I'm walking with confidence. I'm looking up. I'm not afraid to look somebody, you know, in the eye, mm-hmm. acknowledge, I see you, you know?
Yeah.
I don't have my head down. My hands aren't full of things. My hands are free. That makes me a hard target. And then I don't need to be fearful. I can be confident that I'm aware of what's going on. I see the people. I see what's happening. And that's a big difference of just being situationally aware and fearful.
And you mentioned then that the intuition piece, and I'd like to break that down a little bit, because I think that it certainly exists that we have those feelings, and for a good reason. Something feels a little off. I'm not sure that I trust this person. Maybe I shouldn't be here. But oftentimes the other part of our brain comes in and says, well, I don't want to hurt someone's feelings. I don't want to be embarrassed by my friends, any of those types of scenarios. So how do you at Damsel in Defense teach that principle of being able to stand up for yourself? Because we have the intuition. How do we follow it?
Sure. And that's a harder piece, because we've all had those situations where something's off, you know, the hair on your arms stand up or the back of your neck, and you know it. Something is just feels wrong. And it's learning to listen to it. And then it's learning how to get yourself out of a situation. I mean, you don't need to turn around and run, but it's more if you're with friends, hey, something feels off here. I think we should go this way. Mm. Or, you know what? I'm getting a bad vibe. And if you're with a person, it's just you're excusing yourself. Hey, you know what? I need to leave, whatever reason. You know, make something up. My dad used to always say, hey, if you're in a bad situation and you're embarrassed, blame it on me.
Yeah.
He said, tell your friends, hey, I got to leave. My dad will kill me if I'm not home in 5 minutes. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Having a way out that makes you comfortable. Because, it can be embarrassing, or it's not cool, or you feel stupid, whatever it is you're feeling, but it's listening to it and already having a plan. Like, if I start feeling that way, what am I going to say? What am I going to do? How am I going to get out of this? Making a plan in advance, I guess. But don't ever discount your intuition. It's usually spot on.
We're talking with Karen Stastny about Damsel in Defense, basically a way that we can empower ourselves to not be fearful, to be confident, to be able to lead our lives, but to be able to be aware of what may go along around us. A next step of this is actual self-defense. You mentioned an intuition is a great first step in self-defense. That next outward step of whether it be some sort of martial arts or training as far as self-defense, how important is that in this whole scenario?
You know, it depends on the person, honestly. You'd be surprised at how situational awareness and intuition really it does a lot, but there are cases when you're going to need to know how to defend yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And in the statistics that you read and I read, the odds are pretty high that someone that either you or someone you love is going to be affected by assault or domestic violence in your life. You know, it's sad reality. One of the things we like to say at Damsel is my life is worth the fight. It's one of the things we teach, and knowing how to fight back as hard and as long as you can, whether it's for yourself, you know, or somebody else who is important, someone you love, your children or a friend, is critical. And you don't need to have, you mentioned martial arts. That is a way to defend yourself, but you don't have to go through all of that in order to defend yourself. There's a lot of very simple things you can learn to get away, to make it harder for someone to take you. You know, my dad's a police officer. Well, he was. He's retired. I have three sisters. So with three girls, you know, we heard a lot of stuff growing up, you know, lots of things. And he would say, you fight like your life depends on it, because it does. Mm-hmm. He also would tell us things like, don't let anyone get you into a car and to a second location, because at that point, it's a recovery, not a rescue. Mm. Those were hard things to hear as a kid, but they sunk in. And I can still hear my dad's voice today telling me those same words, and him showing us some different things that we could do to, you know, get away, to get, you know, no one's going to grab your hand, but they're going to grab your wrist, getting your arm away from them, and having that mindset that my life is worth the fight.
Let's talk about,
so it's worth educating.
Let's talk about Damsel in Defense. Tell me a little bit more about this project.
So Damsel in Defense is actually a direct sales company. We, our mission is to equip, empower, and educate others to protect themselves and those they love. And our goal is to change statistics, to empower especially women to protect themselves, to give training and resources and tools. And that's what we're about.
Sort of as a side with that, you also have the Damsel House Project. What's that?
That's actually a really, really cool thing that we do. So the Damsel House Project started in 2015. We partnered with Destiny Rescue when we opened our first Damsel House in Cambodia. And the home actually offers safety and healing, educational and vocational training and hope to girls and children that have been rescued out of sex trafficking. Mm. And we have a second house in India. So Destiny Rescue rescues the girls, brings them into the damsel home, and then the damsel home gets them ready to go back out into the world with a purpose, with training, with a job that this keeps, it keeps them free from selling their bodies, basically. And it's an amazing way to give back and help really people who can't help themselves. So all of the products we sell, a portion of those go to fund those homes.
Wow, what a tremendous project that you guys have undertaken. We have less than a minute left with you, and in that time, I guess either reiterate, or if there's something that we've missed, that piece of advice to our sons and our daughters that are going out, give them those best keys to safety, those parental advice that will help them be safe.
The biggest one, like I said, be aware of what's going on around you. Be a hard target. Get your head up and looking around. I like to carry something with me that's non-lethal, a stun device, a pepper spray, something I can use that buys me some time to get away if somebody attacks me. Have something with you. It doesn't even have to be an actual self-defense tool. It could be your cell phone or something else, but have something in your hands all the time that you can use that you know will help you by a few critical seconds to get away should you be attacked.
Great advice from Karen Stastny. She is the Director of Marketing Communications for Damsel in Defense. You can learn more about Damsel in Defense by visiting damselindefense.net or follow them on social media at Damsel in Defense. Now, coming up, we're going to figure out what really means. That's right. We're going to find out what our dogs are actually thinking. Thank you for listening to The Lisa Show. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Lisa Show. The Lisa Show sounds a little bit different. I want to just take a second and let you know that we... Well, the show is different. Lisa of The Lisa Show is not with us this week. She will be back here on The Lisa Show again in the future. I can guarantee you that. Her husband, who over 4 years ago was diagnosed with ALS, he passed away this last weekend. She's taking the time to be with her family and to be able to grieve and to give them everything that they need and everything that she needs. She will be back. If you would love to share a message and she would love to hear from you, you can go to The Lisa Show's Facebook page. There's a post there that you can see the two of them and leave a message there. Also, we've posted our email address, which is thelisashow@byu.edu. Feel free to reach out that way. Send your love, your prayers, whatever that is. I know that Lisa appreciates hearing from each and every one of you, so thank you very much for that. But I did want to make sure that we made mention that's why The Lisa Show sounds a little different. It's a little less Lisa today because she's not here. Now, if you are like me, and you have a dog, sometimes you look at that dog and you think of all the love and all the great things, but then you also start to think, I wonder what that dog is thinking. Is he thinking about me? Does he notice what I'm doing? Is he thinking about the food that's in the bowl that's coming? Is he thinking about, oh man, I really want to be outside? And if you take it to the extra level, like my wife and I do, you start to embody a voice of your pet. The voice for us is, okay, this is what Robert sounds like. That's my my Chihuahua Jack Russell Terrier poodle mix. It sounds like this. Okay, I want to go outside, Daddy. That's how we have embodied his voice. Not his actual voice, come to find out. But you wonder, what are our pets thinking? There's something going on in their minds, whether it be dogs or birds or elephants, all the other animals. But how complex are their thoughts? Well, to help us understand, we've invited Dr. Carl Safina onto the show. He's an endowed professor for nature and humanity at Stony Brook University. Welcome, Carl.
Hi, it's great to be with you.
Let me ask you this. Do you think I've got the voice of Robert right? Do you think it's probably a higher or lower pitch? He's sort of a small dog.
I would simply guess that he doesn't actually sound that way in his own head.
do animals think the same way that we do? Do we just sort of personify them that way and they aren't at all like us? Or are they more like us than we think?
Well, it depends how much like us you think they are. They're not exactly like us. Even most people are not exactly like we are. You know, there are people who think and do things that I find incomprehensible, for instance.
Sure.
And they value things that are different than what I value. So, you know, there's a lot of difference in this. It's not like humans are one thing and everything else in the world is something else.
Sure.
There's a lot of overlap, and each species, each kind of living thing has its own things about it that make it special in what it is. Otherwise, we wouldn't have such diversity. The diversity is an indication of the differences. But there is a lot of overlap, and I've thought about this quite a lot, as you can imagine.
Sure.
In the span of the two books that I've written about it, which was called Beyond Words, it was about what animals think and feel, and the new book, Becoming Wild, which is about culture in non-human animals and how they learn and what they learn socially from one another, and actually why culture exists in the world with other species and with humans. Humans are the most cultural of all species. But in the course of thinking about this, I've tried to think a lot about my perceptions and my thoughts and tried to see them through the eyes and the mind of a creature like our dogs who don't have human-type language. And how would they perceive the world, and how do they think about things, and how do they imagine things compared to how we do? And I've come up with, I think, the following couple or three things.
Okay.
One is the world is very, very vivid to them.
What do you mean by that?
They have superhuman senses. So their noses and their hearing, if it's dogs, are much better than ours. So all of those signals are much more acute in the world to them. If they're birds, their visual acuity is way, way, way beyond that of humans, and their speed of processing is much faster than it is for humans. Speed of processing for many animals is faster than it is for humans. You see their reaction times are much, much quicker. That's even true of our closest relatives, chimpanzees and bonobos.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing is they live a very vivid life. They are very aware of what's going on around them. Do they think and have an imagination of things? To a certain extent, they do. Because, for instance, if I merely touch my car keys, our dogs are right up and they're hoping, and one of them is really pestering that, you know, let's go for a ride. We want to come with you. Don't leave without us. Sometimes they initiate that. One of the dogs, particularly our youngest one, particularly at around the time when I often take them out, she will come looking for me and start jumping around, barking and jumping up on me. She's ready to go. So she is imagining and anticipating that. Same thing at mealtime. if we're late with the food and I'm writing in my writing studio, which is away from my main house, it's in the back of the backyard, she will come looking for me. She's got food on her mind, and she feels the hunger the way we feel hungry when it's, you know, time for us to eat or we've skipped a meal. So there are those things. And then the other thing that I've paid a lot of attention to is we think that we think with language. And I don't think that we think with language. I think the thinking comes first, and then we put the language on top of it.
Okay, you're going to have to break this down a little bit for me.
Yeah, I'm going to try breaking that down for you. Whether we speak English or Hungarian or Vietnamese is a totally arbitrary cultural thing depending on where we were raised.
Okay.
So there's something about our language that's deeper than what language we're speaking. It's our brain's capacity for language. And that means that the thoughts probably are arising before we stick the words on top of them. And I've noticed that for me, there is a lot of that. I have a feeling or I have a thought that then seems to come into words. And because we are the ones who are very, very verbal in that way. Hmm. There are a lot of other animals that are very vocal, but we're very verbal. We're apparently the most verbal of all animals. So that's the part of the world that to us is the most vivid, is the one that's all about words. But if I come into my home and, you know, let's just say that you walk into your house and you glance at the dining room and one of the chairs is toppled over. Mm-hmm. You don't say, oh, look, there's the dining room and one of the chairs is toppled over. You just have an immediate overall impression. Look at what's going on.
Uh-huh.
You don't have to put words on that. Say, you know, you don't have to say, oh, there's the refrigerator, there's the sink, now I'm in my kitchen.
I love this scenario, though, if we did actually what you were saying, where we come in and sort of label and declare everything before we have an emotion. You're right, though. This is helping me understand. Sorry to interrupt.
Well,
go
you
on.
Know, yeah, you, no. I'm sorry to go on. But, you know, just to cap that thought, you don't walk into your home and say, oh, wow, there's a person in here. Who is that person? Oh, it's my spouse. Wow, she sure is sexy. I mean, you don't do that, right? you know your life and you perceive it. You perceive it basically because we're kind of visual, we perceive it in a picture. Dogs, I think, also can perceive scents and those kinds of things that give them an overall understanding of what's up.
We're talking with Dr. Carl Safina about animal thoughts, about thoughts and words and language and the sensitivity of senses. This has been pretty fascinating. I want to do a hard stop with the way that we were talking and in the remaining time that we have be able to discuss. So knowing what we have discussed, what do we do differently? Or is it just a curiosity worth flushing out or so what, I guess?
Well, I think the big so what is that as I sometimes say, and as I wrote in one of my other books, the geometry of human progress is an expanding circle of compassion. And we've seen that, you know, with humans, who is inside the circle of what you care about and who you care about has changed a lot over the centuries. We're having a big and ugly debate about that right now in our country.
Yeah.
It's very, very sad to me that, you know, literally 50 years after I watched Police Dogs and Fire Hoses and heard Martin Luther King speaking on television, we're reliving a lot of the same ugliness, and there's absolutely no reason for any of it. It's a terrible thing about us. And it has a lot to do with who's inside the circle of compassion. And I think as far as other animals are concerned, to realize that their lives are vivid, their lives mean something to them. They run from danger. They want to stay alive. And many of them are very, you know, they're very vigorous and very vibrant about their lives. Our dogs, for instance, the one animal that we tend to know well because we see them a lot and live with them, they have a lot of joy in being alive every day. And if a creature of any kind has a sense of who they are and where they are and wants to stay alive and can obviously enjoy life or be made miserable, then the implications are obvious. The moral compass to that is everything wants to be comfortable and wants to be happy. And you can either let them do that or help them do that, or you can get in the way of that and make things uglier. And I think that a thing in the world is right if it tends to add beauty and compassion, and I think it's wrong if it adds cruelty and ugliness.
So we've got about a minute left, Carl. Let me ask you, what then can we learn? What can we take away from our animals and the way that they interact in the world that will help us be happier, more complete, joyful people?
Well, I think that, you know, first of all, the world is a beautiful, beautiful place, and we are taking from the world a lot of what many, many millions of animals need to live. I'm talking about wild animals and wild habitats. And most of our farm animals are made to live much worse than they're made to die. And I think that, you know, when you serve, the human mind is happiest when it serves a larger purpose. And I think that if we are simply kind and compassionate, we get happy.
I like that. I like that a lot. Dr. Carl Safina is an expert of ecology and an author. You can find his most recent book, Becoming Wild, How Animal Cultures Raise Family, Create Beauty, and Achieve Peace by going to his website, carlsafina.org. Thanks for being with us. While you're online, head over to byuradio.org/Lisa. You can enter for a chance to win an annual National Parks Pass as part of Lisa's Adventure Club. We're giving them away every Friday. I'm looking forward to it again this Friday, where we call up one lucky listener and let them know that they have, in fact, won an annual National Parks Pass. Maybe it's self-explanatory. I'm going to take a second to explain it to you just in case. An annual National Parks Pass gets you in for an entire year to any of the national parks. Whether you just go one time or you go every day for that entire year, who knows? Maybe you quit your job and you start a travel blog and then we feature you here on The Lisa Show. That could be something that happens. Or maybe you just go one time. I'm not going to be the boss of you at all, except to tell you, you need to go to byuradio.org/Lisa to enter for a chance to win. If you don't enter, I can 100% guarantee to you, you will never win. Look for the big banner that says Lisa's Adventure Club. Coming up, we're going to find out what impact protests actually have. Thanks for listening to The Lisa Show. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Lisa Show.
You make my life better.
Everything I need in the morning.
It's my favorite show ever.
They keep it fun in the morning.
I love you guys. I love you guys.
Welcome to The Lisa Show. I am Richie T. Thank you so much for joining us. Coming up this hour, have you participated in a protest lately? We're going to find out what kind of changes a protest can actually make. Then we're going to discuss if summer camp is still a good idea given the current status of this nation. Coming up in just 15 short minutes as part of your morning buzz. I promised yesterday as part of our morning buzz, and today I deliver. What am I talking about? Well, an amazing trailer that dropped yesterday. We'll get into it coming up. Now, every Wednesday here on The Lisa Show, we like to highlight people that are doing amazing, significant things. And amazing and significant can be up to your own definition. We're not going to put labels on you. You think it's amazing and significant? That's all it needs to be. You can send us along in an email to thelisashow@byu.edu. We call it an everyday rock star. Make sure you put everyday rock star in the subject line so we know that that's what it's for, and then we highlight him here on the show.
The Lisa Show's Everyday Rockstar.
Hey! Have you ever wondered what happens to research animals when the research is done? Well, one biology professor at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay has been helping intelligent lab rats retire to good homes for the past 20 years. His name is Richard Hine, and he joins us today as our everyday rock star. Welcome, Rick.
Well, thank you very much.
Now, is the program actually called Adopt a Rat?
Yeah, that's what I've coined it. And it's an effort to get students and community members interested in providing good homes for our research animals.
So walk us back that 20 years ago when you found and saw this need and then thought of these little four-legged creatures.
Yep. So when I first began teaching at University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, I teach the freshman and sophomore biology courses, and I know it's really important to get students actually doing science. And one of the projects that I wanted them to work with are live animal models. But part of working with live animals like intelligent rats is to use them very responsibly. And that's one of the things that I wanted to teach my students. So at the end of the experimentation, at the end of the academic year, part of that responsibility extends to finding them good homes to live out their lives after the work the students do with them.
But they're rats. Do people have some resistance towards that?
Some do, and that's one of the other really important benefits of introducing students to working with live animals is many of them don't have that experience growing up. So many of them come in really nervous about working with the animals, but they realize that they're very social, very intelligent, and just wonderful animals to work with. And usually about half the rats that we work with go to the students that actually work with them.
So I have to just marvel at this thing, something that probably would have been neglected or not even a second thought to a lot of folks. You have not only been able to find great homes for these rats, but also you're saying this is a tremendously educational experience.
Oh, for sure. And it's one of the rare places, I think, that students actually get this opportunity really early in their career. So my goal is to provide my students with this experience. And it is a lot of work working with animals.
Sure.
There are a number of protocols you have to go through. You need approval through the institution. There's oversight by federal groups. So a lot of people opt not to do that until students get further along in their careers. But to me, that effort's really worth it to get students coming in as freshmen and sophomores really engaged in doing the work.
We have about a minute left in the time that we have with you. And I guess I would just ask, is there a particular student that this program has benefited or something that it has benefited you that maybe you didn't see coming as you began this program?
Yeah, I don't have any specific examples, but I do have multiple students that contact me later on in time. And usually it's about when I'm running the Adopt-A-Rat program, they see something on social media and they get back in touch with me and they say, hey, I just wanted to let you know that experience really was a career changer for me. And many of them have gone on in healthcare fields, in research, and graduate school even. And many of them point to these really high-impact experiences working in the laboratory, open-ended experiments with animals, as one of the real highlights of their undergraduate career.
Making a huge difference in students' lives and certainly in the lives of those rats. I can't even believe I'm saying it, an Adopt-A-Rat program. Rick Hine, you are our everyday rock star. If you know someone in your life that you want to nominate to be that everyday rock star, you can send us those everyday rock star moments or nominations to thelisashow@byu.edu. If you've been paying attention to the news recently, you'll have noticed that protests have been erupting across the nation in response to the murder of George Floyd. All 50 states have now witnessed widespread demonstrations within their own borders in support of the Black Lives Matter movement and condemning police brutality. The right to peaceably assemble is held dear by all Americans, and protesting has been used throughout history to enact change in society and government. We wanted to find out more about what constitutes as a protest and what protesters should do when the march is over for real change to happen. Joining our conversation is protest and social movement expert Pamela Oliver. Welcome, Pamela.
Well, thank you. Good morning.
I want to start out. A lot of discussion is had around what is a protest and what isn't a protest. So let's start there.
Well, there's a wide range of activities that are protests. So you can say a protest is anything you're doing to push back against what more powerful people are doing when you don't have the power to just do what you want. So many people understand it as taking a march or a demonstration or a rally. There's also civil disobedience, where you break the law that you're trying to protest, or you engage in some sort of mildly illegal activity as a way of disrupting ordinary events to call attention to your issue. Mm-hmm. And then that ranges. Many of us would count strikes and boycotts as protests. Also, there are more aggressive forms of protests that the traditionally poor people would riot, attempt to attack, perhaps kill the manor lord, or fight with the police, or battle in the streets, or burn. All of those can be acts of protest. Mm-hmm. So there's a full range of actions that could be protests.
In this day and age, and certainly with the protests surrounding George Floyd, it seems like there has been a trying to be clear delineation between a protest and a riot, or, you know, those people are not us. We are, you know, peaceably protesting and doing this the right way, whereas others would not have it be. Is that fair to say?
It's certainly fair to say that people have been talking that way and try to do that. And there's actually debates among academics about how strong a line you should draw. There's definitely different groups of people doing different kinds of activities. That's mm-hmm. for sure true. And in general, the organizations, the organizers, the people who are planning protests mostly are trying to plan peaceful, disruptive protests. Now, some people's definition of peaceful is you don't get in my way. You're just over there somewhere else where I can ignore you. Mm-hmm. So there are some people who don't use the term peaceful. Let's say you block a highway, you tie up traffic for a while. Mm-hmm. That is a peaceful protest, but there are some people who don't want to use the term peaceful for that if it gets in their way. So what you actually find is there's certainly a distinction between burning things, killing people at one end of a continuum, and standing vigil, praying in public as a way of expressing dissent at the other. Mm-hmm. But there's also always a debate about just what counts as peaceful.
You know, and I am no student of history, but as I think about protests, and certainly here in the United States, a few key moments in history come to mind. I know a lot of people have been discussing and likening or disliking, depending, the Boston Tea Party to what's going on currently. Mm-hmm. Certainly the protests with the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s, and then compare it to today. Are there more examples in our nation's history that are worth pointing out at this point?
Well, I was trying to remember. So you certainly have the women's suffrage protests, which the women actually went to jail for protesting for the right to vote. So those were happening. 1930s, there were a lot of marches and protests as people were poor and hungry, and there was an encampment in Washington, D.C. of veterans protesting that they were now starving, and they had a tent city in Washington, D.C. as a protest. Anti-war protests, so there were protests against nuclear weapons, protests against various wars over time. Of course, the 1960s had the civil rights movement, but it also had the anti-war movement, which was a great deal of protesting.
So then along with that, as we look at these marked times of protest in our nation's history, certainly we have seen that some things have changed from a result of protest. but it isn't always necessarily the case, or is that what the continual continuation of a protest hopes to do? Right, we continue to protest until those changes are made.
You pretty much got it. So protest does not always win. You know, if you think about it, if you're getting what you want, you don't protest at all.
Right.
So protest is rarely done by the people in power. You protest because you don't have the power to get what you want. And sometimes it works. You gain other people to your side, or you put enough pressure on the people in power that they yield and give what you want. Other times you protest and protest and you just keep losing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's certainly not a given thing that just because you protest, you're going to get what you want.
As you've taken the opportunity to certainly study protests and social movements, it's a curious study for me, because I think that you're able to look back and go, okay, well, in this given scenario, this was what they were protesting against. This was the outcome. And because you're looking from a future glance, you can point to the different times and people and situations that may have mapped out for that change to occur. What is it about this protest that's going on in our nation now that actually seems to be invoking change?
That's an interesting question, and scholars are discussing it now. My own view is, first of all, not certain. But I think if you pay attention, you'll realize that we were having exactly these same protests in 2014 to 2016, and the protests really have been continuing at a lower rate since 2016. So the work to be raising public awareness of the issue has actually been going on a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's one factor that's playing into it. Obviously, another factor is that the particular police killing in this case was just so horrifying and egregious that it just racked people's consciences. But I think also it's tying in with the broader concerns that many people have. So there have been a lot of protests going on in some segments of the society since the election of Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a group of people who are generally concerned about the direction of the country, and this is one of the issues that's concerning them, among others. So I think it's a combination of what we call movement building, where the Black Lives Matter organizations have actually been continuing to work and continuing to reach out and organize, so that they, when this event came up and there was such outrage, they were prepared to not only conduct protests, but to actually have proposals about what they wanted, because they'd been working on the issue. And then just tying in with all the other factors that are going on in society right now.
Sure. It's an interesting thing, and the discussion has had over social media, certainly about this issue, but others as well. Is it enough to just protest, to just show up at your local city, municipality, or state protest and be with people, or to protest? Is there an additional step?
Well, I think the movement wants people to take additional steps. So for protesting is sort of part one, it's putting pressure on the system, but people are also lobbying, certainly in my community, and I think in many communities, people are engaging in letter writing and so forth, campaigns around specific local reforms that they want.
Mm-hmm.
You also see another thing that's happening is pressure on institutions, for example, within universities or within churches, to make sure that you address the issues within your institution. So there are definitely calls for people to take this awareness, either about policing issues and criminal justice issues, or about racism, or both, and take them back into all the other places that you are participating.
How valuable, and maybe this is a softball question because I know the answer, I just want to create this discussion about it. How valuable is the ability to communicate around what we're protesting?
Well, I certainly think that people want to know what the issues are, and so traditionally the mass media played an important role and still does. Actually, one of the things that I study is media coverage of protests and demonstrations, and we actually look at how mass media creates narratives of protests and narratives of issues, and shapes public opinion in ways that may be different from what the people on the ground were actually doing.
Huh.
But then also, social media has become a way of people are also trying to shape narratives and shape stories about what is the meaning of the protest and how should you understand the issue and trying to influence their friends and relatives. So definitely these acts of communication as people are trying to influence each other and tell stories and tell understandings about how to think about the issues are an important part of what's happening in the social movement. And in many ways, the protests kind of have two purposes. One is they are coercive, they are trying to demonstrate to the people in power mm-hmm. that there are citizens, voting citizens, who care about these issues. And so that's one meaning of protests. And then the other meaning of protests is as communication, to draw attention to an issue.
Yeah, this will be just an amazing case study as to how these changes were able to be enacted. The fact that all 50 states in the United States have taken the opportunity to have a protest and that we see that actual change is occurring is it's pretty awesome to see the power of the American people when we don't agree with something, that we are able to unite and that we have mm-hmm, the freedom mm-hmm. to be able to do so. Pamela Oliver is a protest and social movement expert. She's also a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She is a professor of sociology there, and thank you so much for joining with us. Now, coming up on the show, we're going to talk about summer camps, a thing I always wanted to do as a kid. But would it be safe this summer, given the current worldwide pandemic? We're going to talk all about that. And coming up in your Morning Buzz, we're talking about the Face the Music, Bill and Ted Most Excellent trailer. You're listening to The Lisa Show. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Lisa Show. Thank you so much for listening. Later this hour, are you struggling to maintain a long-distance relationship? Well, we're going to tell you about the common mistakes that you may be making. But first, I've got your Morning Buzz. It's three stories that are trending online right now. I want to share them with you so that you may be more informed. So that if in the event that you ever have water cooler talk again in the future, you'll know you can count on the Morning Buzz to give you those topics that you would talk about. The first one, you probably heard of the Dow Jones. You also, along with the Dow Jones, have heard of the NASDAQ. Well, it's an index that includes stocks like Microsoft and Tesla. Well, for the first time ever, yesterday, it topped over 10,000, which is significant. How significant? I don't know exactly. I just know that the internet is saying this has never been done before and that it's a good sign. The index has surged 11% this year. So as we talk about things in our economy not necessarily doing so well, this is a good sign. The NASDAQ topping 10,000. Also, this is super cool technology. I want you to think about Indiana Jones or any other archaeologist that may come to mind if I say archaeology, and you think of like dirt and the little brushes and you're scraping things away and whatever. Well, modern technology now in Italy has allowed them to map an entire ancient Roman town by plane using radar. And it is the coolest thing. This is trending online right now. I'm going to do my best in my finest Italian to pronounce the name of this town, which is Falieri Novi. That may be wholly inaccurate. It's 50 kilometers north of Rome, and it is this cool ancient Roman town that they have been able, the way that radar bounces off the under part of the, I don't understand it. It's just awesome. It's a cool sight to behold. You can find that trending online. And while you're there, take the, I think it's minute and 27 seconds, and watch the trailer for Bill and Ted Face the Music. I mentioned this yesterday. I told you it was coming out. It has in fact come out, and it's so great for people of a certain generation. You have to see Bill and Ted. They've reunited. They're going to save the world. It's Keanu Reeves and the other guy that nobody can remember his name. You know, it's Bill and then the other guy that we don't know. You can see that trending online right now. My bet? I don't know. Listen, I'll go see it. I'm not sure it's going to be a great movie. Bill and Ted's Face the Music coming out later this summer to an actual theater. That's your morning buzz. Summer camp for me. Growing up, I watched like the movies that you'd see about summer camp. It's a chance for you to be away from your family, right? They drop you off and then you're there for the summer and there's adventures and hijinks and maybe you fall in love. I was romanticized by this idea of summer camp. Never got the opportunity to go. Went a couple times to like day camps. Wasn't like what I had seen in the TV or in the movies. Maybe summer camp is part of your child's summer plans, or is it? Right now, with the COVID-19 restrictions, there are a lot of people who are thinking, well, we had planned to send them away to a summer camp, but is it safe? Are they even open? And how can we best navigate that situation of sending our kids to a summer camp? So here to talk a little bit about that is Clint Salter, who is a dance industry expert helping studio owners get back to business in the safest way possible. He has some advice for parents about summer camps, and we wanted to hear all about it. Welcome in, Clint.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
So when we talk about these summer camps, are they still happening?
So some summer camps are happening, but in a new and different way that we haven't experienced. So you talk about dropping off your child and leaving there for summer. That's not happening. So summer camps are either happening in person with restrictions in place. So that might be the amount of children they can take in the summer camp, but it's also restricted operating hours. So with our studio owners who might have done a 1 to a 4 week long summer camp, their summer camps now, if they're in person, might be half a day. So they might be 4 hours coming once a day for a week. And they're also, the children are also in the same group with the same teacher or facilitator. So last year, when you would have sent your child to summer camp, they would have been mixing with lots of different children from lots of different age groups with different facilitators. That's changing because we want to ensure that the children don't have access to lots of different people during their time. So that's what's happening if they're in person. So no, they're not going to be sent away for a month, you know, doing sleepovers and mixing with hundreds and hundreds of children. It's summer camp with a lot of restrictions in place, really putting safety at the core of that plan.
I think that you hit on a very important thing is that, first of all, some people may just be even wondering, right? They've started to muse about this. Are any types of summer camps existing? And you're here to say yes, but they do, in fact, look different than maybe they have in the past. As we send or look to send our kids to these summer camps, what kind of conversations do we need to be having with our kids to make sure that they're safe?
Sure. So the first thing we want to do actually is ensure that where we are sending our children that they have a COVID safety plan in place and they have COVID protocol. And so looking at their social media accounts, looking at their website, talking to the organizers to say, hey, what are you doing to ensure that my child is going to be as safe as possible? That's the first step. The second step is then being able to pass that information on to your child and having a conversation with them to see their comfort level of going to a summer camp as well and sharing with them the things that they can be doing during the day at the camp to stay safe. And we all know about washing our hands. We all know about hand sanitizer. Depending on how young the child is, you know, if it's a six-year-old or a four-year-old, it's going to be a tricky conversation because they're going to be going up to their friends and in our dance studio, you know, they're licking the mirrors or licking the floor and it's a trickier environment to be able to control. But having continuous, courageous communication this time with the companies that we want to engage with and also our children is going to be really key.
I like that you say that we start the conversation with asking about that organization's either cleanliness or safety protocol. And and if, in fact, they retort, hey, we don't have one or well, they'll be fine, that probably is not going to be a great place to send our children.
For sure. You want to make sure that the companies that you're engaging with these summer camps have really thought about it, have mapped it out. I know with our studio owners, they have mapped out their entire customer journey inside of their dance studio. So you will see tape on the floor. You will see stickers where you can stand that are separated 6 feet apart. You will see boxes that are being taped out inside of the studio where students need to stand during their classes. You'll see hand sanitizer in every space. You'll see separate entries for the different studios. So you want to engage with a company that has really thought through this and is doing a really great job at communicating what they've put in place to combat as much as possible, you know, your child mixing with lots of different people during their summer camp experience.
We're talking with Clint Salter about summer camp cautions, ways that we can have our kids be able to, you know, be in those traditional experiences, though they may look different this year than they have in years past. There certainly is value in these camps, these away from home experiences. What are they?
Please send your child to a summer camp. And I want to mention that a lot of our studio owners are doing virtual summer camp. So you might not want to send them physically into a space. You can definitely still have them engaged. First and foremost is they're finishing school. And so that engagement that they've had with their friends and their teachers online, that is going to go away. And they need to keep that social interaction, even if it is online. So that's the first thing, social interaction. The second thing is just creativity and finding joy and being a child. It's hard to do that when we're just stuck inside all day, especially if we're on our screens and we're not getting outside and experiencing nature and we're not being creative. And summer camp is known for us being active, being creative and engaging. And so there are things that we're not going to get now because we're not doing school. School will be over. And so please send your child to a summer camp, even if it isn't a virtual option that you feel comfortable with.
And I think there's value also on the other side of that, the economical impact of these arts institutions specifically, but these camps in general, they're not going to be able to exist if we don't patronize them.
Thanks so much for mentioning that. What we've been saying with our studio owners and what they've been communicating with their parents is thank you for your support. This is going to ensure that we're going to be here next season. And it's exactly the same with the summer camps. If we do not support them now, there's probably not going to be a summer camp for your child to go to next year. So what we're doing now is really helping small business owners, these camp organizers, to make sure that they are around for many years to come.
Now, one of the things that I think of, especially in one of these artistic things, is that there's usually a showcase or a final performance at the end of that. Moving it into the online space, how are you guys doing that?
It's been really awesome to see. Our studio owners are very creative individuals, and they've been very innovative. So we've seen a couple of different versions of recital. The first one has been that parents have filmed their child and sent the video in of their child performing their routines, and then the studio owners are editing them together and doing a virtual recital where everyone sits on a Friday night, they're ordering pizza, and they watch the virtual recital that's streamed live, which is super fun. We've had some people that have done drive-by recitals where they're at their studio in person, but it's one person at a time, and they have a red carpet, and they get to take a photo, and then they get to perform their routine, and that gets filmed and streamed online as well. So there's been some really cool things. Someone rented out a drive-in movie theater where people can drive in, sit in their cars, eat, and like watch the filmed recital on the big screen. Someone rented a raceway track as well to
do
it there outside. Someone did it in the car park, and they got a little stage constructed and have been doing it in the car park of their studio. So it has been a really challenging time for our industry, but so much creativity has come out of it, which has been really great to see.
One of the things that, you know, I feel like I've said just time and time again in this pandemic time is that necessity, the need for these things like this has really driven our, not only our invention, but our creation. And some of those examples that you just gave, I would have never thought of renting out a racetrack or a whole movie theater to be able to share and experience some of the things that you guys provide. In our remaining minutes, that we have with you specifically about dance and about the expressive nature of it. Why is that so valuable for our kids to have an outlet?
Sure. Well, firstly, I mean, it keeps them active, creative, healthy, and socially engaged. You know, we have seen so many, especially with our teenage students, who have been struggling with depression, who have been feeling isolated. And dance is a universal language. We all understand it. We don't have to be great at it. We can all do it. And it brings a lot of joy. And so in a time of chaos, in uncertainty, in these times of where we've been very challenged, it's such a great outlet to find joy in these moments that have been tough for so many people. And parents, it's really about routine. Children really thrive in routine, and parents like having a routine for their children as well. And so having that regular dance class or that regular time of day where you go to your summer camp is really important, because we're going to go from having no routine, well, hopefully not, but a lot of people are going to go from no routine to being straight back into school when we go back in the fall. And there's a lot of routine there. So we want to make sure that we keep some routine as much as possible.
Yeah, good advice, because like a lot of us adults will feel as we go back to a regular routine of work, if we haven't kept that routine in some aspect in our own life, that's going to be a long haul from pajama work to in the office work. A great lesson. Clint Salter.
Yeah, it's going to be really hard.
He is the founder and CEO of the Dance Studio Owners Association. You can learn more about him and the Dance Studio Owners Association by going to DSOA.com. Now, coming up, we're going to discuss unique ways to connect with your partner in a long-distance relationship. You're listening to The Lisa Show. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Lisa Show. Thank you so much for joining us. As you've been listening this morning, you might recognize that there is a little bit of a different sound here on The Lisa Show. That is no Lisa. She is at home spending time with her family, her husband of over 25 years, who was diagnosed with ALS just over 4 years ago. He passed away this past weekend, and she is spending time being able to be with her family and make the necessary preparations and also to be able to grieve. And we're grateful to be able to give her that time. I know for people that are listening, they go, where's Lisa? And I just wanted to make sure that we address that right on so that you knew what was going on. Also, I should let you know, Lisa looks forward to being able to come back, and she will come back after she's taken the necessary time that she needs. A lot of people have reached out to us here at The Lisa Show and said, hey, you know what, I want to, you know, send my prayers and my thoughts and condolences. And we're directing everyone to The Lisa Show Facebook page. There's a post there of Lisa and Chris, her husband, and you can comment on that post. Also, there is the email address, thelisashow@byu.edu. If you feel compelled to send a message, I want you to know that Lisa will and does, in fact, see all of those. So if you feel compelled to do so, she would love to hear from you. It's thelisashow@byu.edu or The Lisa Show on Facebook. Moving to long-distance relationships, when I was a single person and I met someone that I really liked and they said, hey, guess what? I'm moving away. I would quickly say, all right, well, then I guess we're done. I had an opportunity in my early 20s to try and engage in a long-distance relationship, and it was, I don't know that I would say the hardest thing of my life, but really difficult. The connections that a relationship provides is made that much harder if your distance isn't, you know, in the same town or in the same neighborhood. So how can we be able to navigate long distance relationships? What tech is available and what patterns, what communication styles can we invoke to be able to help us have better long-distance relationships? Well, that was the question. So we're bringing in Liz Kaliza to help us, you know, navigate if we find ourselves in that long-distance relationship. How can we come out of it successful? Welcome, Liz.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's a difficult thing. I probably am not alone in that fear of long distance relationships. I hope, anyway.
No, you're absolutely not. That's actually a great starting point. You know, I think that is kind of the general first reaction we have toward long distance relationships. And I don't know if this is what you were feeling, but, you know, long distance relationships feel like a lot more work. And in a lot of ways they are because of the uniqueness.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, and I also think that we know the cost of a long distance relationship, right? There's two endings for a long distance relationship. You're either going to give up a lot, one of you, to move to be near the other person,
mm-hmm.
right? Which is going to cost somebody so much, or you're going to end up breaking up. And you both put in all this work and all this time and not have a future with that person. And so I think the fear of what it's going to cost is so high. And I also think with long distance relationships, there's a higher level of uncertainty and unknown because you're not together all the time. You're not able to see each other as much.
You're not making a great case for a long distance relationship. So why would we do this?
Yeah, you're right. Right, we're talking about the fear of it.
Yeah, I mean, cost benefit. I'm out.
Right, right, and that's how most people feel. And I think, I think though there are long distance relationships, they can succeed, especially now in this time where we have access to each other at any time during the day. Right, we have access now. We have access to virtually tour museums if we wanted to together. Right.
Mm-hmm.
I think the reason to go toward a long distance relationship is because it can be so worth it in the long run. And all relationships take an incredible amount of work. You know, I think anyone that's been married for longer than, you know, let's say 2 years, is going to say that marriage is probably the hardest thing they've done, or one of the hardest things they've done, right?
Sure.
You know, because actually putting in the work and the time to keep up an emotional connection is a lot. And I think, you know, right now we're in an age where it's harder. People are getting married later and it's harder to meet people organically if you haven't met them in high school and college. And a lot of people are meeting online. And so what if you do meet that person, but they live two or three states over?
Right.
Then
how do you do it? And as you mentioned, sort of at the key up of this conversation, who's going to make the sacrifice? And in some ways it almost becomes not a power struggle, but I mean, it is the who's going to be the one to compromise, who has less to lose, you know, more to gain. All those considerations start coming in. I think it's also worth noting that when we talk about long distance relationships, to me, in my mind, there almost seems like there's two kinds of long distance relationships. Those for maybe those short or determinate amount of times. And then there's just those relationships that are kind of at large. Like I'm thinking of, you know, the spouse who gets called to active duty, and we know that that spouse is going to be gone for 6 months. That is different than what you're talking about, where we meet online and you live, you know, four or five states away, and we don't have that relationship already established. Some principles are the same, but those are kind of two different types of long distance relationships in structure.
Yes, they definitely are. It's different if you're meeting someone and you're dating, you know, and then you don't want that long distance to continue forever. You have to have an end goal in sight, right? But if you're married or committed with someone and then they sign up for a job and they're deployed, say, a couple times a year, then you enter into an on and off long distance relationship that you have to figure out how to make it work. Or, you know, someone needs to make a huge sacrifice. But I think sacrifice, right, is something that we also can often have a negative like reaction to.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if we look at relationships are built on small sacrifices between two people over time, any type of relationship, right? Sacrifice is what builds a connection and builds dependency and trust in relationships.
Yeah, it's those sacrifices that you make for each other and with each other that really build it. I had one of my best friends from college. He and his wife, that was going to go to law school, and the opportunity for her was a couple of hours away from where they presently lived. And his job was so great, but it had to be in the particular city that he was in. So Monday through Thursday, she would go to school in this particular town a couple of hours away, and they were sort of weekend married. And I know that's not the full scope of a long distance relationship like we've been talking about, but I saw that, observed that from afar, and thought, man, what a tremendous amount of sacrifice that those two had for each other. And now they've been reunited, and the relationship, I think they would say, would not be as strong without that experience.
Yeah, that's a good testimony to making it work long distance. And as I think about that couple, right, I think, well, they knew that there was an end in sight.
Yeah.
It was temporary,
yeah.
Right, which gives you a different parameter and kind of perspective on what you're doing.
We're talking with Liz Kaliza about long-distance relationships. So now let's pivot the conversation to how we can make these successful. Something that sort of come organically out of our discussion is almost this phrase, begin with an end in mind as far as our long-distance relationships. What are other things that will help those be successful?
Yeah. And I think, you know, we have two different kind of relationship types that we're talking about. One is you're starting to date and you find someone long distance and your relationship starts as a long distance relationship. And then we have people that are already in a relationship and they move to being long distance. Mm-hmm. And I think with both of those, I think, you know, both people need to really think through what are their expectations for the relationship and what do they need to make this work? You know, and with every relationship, the underlying question is, will you be there for me between two people? Mm-hmm. And so when you go long distance, you have to think through how are you going to be there for each other? And you're going to have to renegotiate so many aspects. You know, if you've been geographically close, you're going to have to renegotiate all of the ways that you interact so that you can meet each other's needs emotionally from afar. And if you're starting out long distance, right, then you're going to have to do some upfront work to really be clear on what your intentions are and your expectations. Which I think that can also be scary for people, right? Because you really do need to, if you want to make it work in a healthy way, you need to talk about some things up front with someone that you're just starting to date that maybe wouldn't be talked about as kind of openly and honestly, right? But you need to talk through kind of how are you going to communicate? How much communication do you need? It's good to set a schedule for communicating and make sure that both of you are feeling satisfied enough with how you're interacting, right? Via phone, email, text, all the different ways, right? And then what are your boundaries for each other? You know, so you need to set clear rules and boundaries for your relationship. And that's going to be different if you're just starting to date versus being in a committed relationship. You know, but what do you feel okay with each other doing when you're apart? Is it okay for you to hang out with people that you feel attraction to or that you could potentially feel an attraction to? Is it okay for you guys to hang out with coworkers? Is it okay to hang out with people late at night? And to just be very clear about what you're expecting from each other. And then I think, you know, I think one of the huge things about to be able to make a long distance relationship work is to always plan the next time you're going to see each other.
Mm. You know, so you really, always have that thing to look forward to.
Yes. And looking forward to together, right?
Yeah.
It's not
yeah.
something that one of you is looking forward to. And then I think, you know, I was already kind of saying this, but I think a huge part of being long distance is that you're relying a lot on verbal communication. And that can be uncomfortable for some people, especially, you know, if we're used to seeing that other person in person, face to face. But you really need to practice putting how you're feeling into words. And so that can be a challenge. But you can't rely on your partner being able to pick up on as much just because you don't have those natural touch points or rhythms to your relationship in person. And so actually expressing how you're feeling over the phone or over text or over email is going to help you to develop or sustain an emotional connection.
You spoke a lot about the boundaries, both in behavior and also the construct of what the communication would look like. Do you recommend actually writing that out and being like, hey, this is how we are going to do this? Or maybe that's not necessary. It's just sort of an understood, a spoken but not written thing. Or what advice do you have as far as that goes?
Yeah, you could. I mean, this is going to vary from couple to couple, right? And different people have different ways of helping their mind remember things, right?
Mm-hmm.
I could very much see it being a very helpful, healthy thing for couples to, you know, for you to put into your calendar that you have, you know, a phone call with your partner every other day or every day at the same time, right? If that's something that you need to schedule in so you don't overlap with other things. And that gets tricky when you're in different time zones too, and you probably have to be even more intentional. But if you need to write it through and kind of talk through, here's kind of how we're going to see the next month going, that's very intentional. And if that works for the two of you, then that's great.
So I want to walk you down a conversation that has probably occurred before.
I say
probably because I don't want to be too self-divulging. But you have this conversation where for whatever reason, the relationship is going to be going long distance. One of the involved parties is like, listen, we'll make it work. And the other one just very frankly says, I don't think I can do this. Do you feel like that person, like it's some sort of discount of their love, or they're just self-aware enough to know, I know that my needs won't be able to be met in a long distance type capacity?
Yeah, and we're talking a dating relationship here, right?
Yes.
I think in some ways that's someone knowing kind of their limitations too. You know, I think we all know people that are able to maintain, even if we talk about friendships, some people are able to maintain friendships from past seasons of their life, and some people just don't. And it's a hard thing for them to think and to put that into kind of their regular everyday. But I mean, that's hard to know, right? We can't know that person's feelings and thoughts. Maybe it is a fear of what that's going to cost them to go long distance. Mm-hmm. Maybe that was a natural break for them to be able to kindly say, this actually isn't working for me. But I think, you know, if it is someone that you feel that you could see a future with, right, commitment is really in question, right? What are you willing to put toward that relationship, and how much are you wanting to work to make it work? And a lot of times relationships really are resting in just levels of commitment, right? When the emotions are low, mm-hmm. but they are committed to that person. That's a hard question to know. I'd say it could go either way.
As we look to maybe have a long distance relationship, whether it's that we're married and for a time that spouse is going to be away, military or schooling or whatever that thing may be, or we are we're dating and have met someone that lives away from us, or maybe they, you know, it was a budding relationship and then they ended up having to be away for a while. What's the value in meeting with a counselor, even in those dating relationships, to help set those boundaries for long distance relationships?
I think there's huge value, and you're obviously talking to a therapist. And so
yeah.
I'm going to say, yes, there's so much value. And I have worked with couples that are dating and it's long distance, and just having a third person to ask those questions, you know, of the two people while they're in the same room or when they're on video, and have them really talk through specifics, you know, because I think sometimes with our partner, we can shy away from, or we have a hard time thinking through what are the actual kind of details and minutiae of how we interact and relate to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And a couples therapist can really help you talk through, right, what emotionally this is like for you, and when do you feel connected to your partner, and what helps you to stay connected to them, and how do you handle when you're feeling uncertainty or insecurity in your relationship? So, I think whether you're dating or in a committed relationship, a therapist can definitely help with long-distance relationships.
For some people listening to this, though, the idea of going to a therapist as they're just dating someone either may be new or may have a stigma, like, you know, therapists are for when your marriage is falling apart. How can we have that discussion to help people really have just healthier relationships by being able to be more welcoming to a therapist?
Yeah. And I think I don't know if you announced this before interviewing me, but I started an app called Lasting that is for couples in all seasons of life. And we actually have specific sessions on there that you can go in, and you and your partner can both be in the app going through questions that are all about dating. There's a long distance session, and then there's also a premarital session. And then all of the other sessions are about these different aspects of healthy relationships. So we created our app to help all types of couples love each other better.
Mm.
We have found that long distance couples, whatever the reason that they're long distance, are finding a lot of value in the app and are able to connect, because you basically go through these questions and you talk about different things via chat or answering the questions, and then you're able to compare your answers and then hopefully take that conversation out of the app and onto either, you know, your FaceTime call or the next time you see each other in person.
So within the app, it's essentially like different lessons, like being able to communicate, and there are those questions and prompts. Am I understanding the use of the app correctly?
Yeah. There's some psychoeducation in there about, we did a lot of research to look at what makes healthy relationships thrive. And we took all that research and then we created these exercises that you and your partner can do, and your apps are synced up so that as you're answering these hard questions, your partner can see your answers.
Oh.
So you don't even have to find the courage or the gumption to initiate those conversations in person. The app helps you to do that, which I think is a huge way to help couples move in that direction.
Yeah, very empowering. It's called Lasting, and people can get it on Android and iPhone, I hope.
Yes, both.
And people can follow you on Instagram at GetLasting. Liz Kaliza is our guest, a parenting therapist and couples therapist based in St. Louis, Missouri, a co-developer of that app Lasting. Thank you so much for being with us, Liz. A quick reminder that here on the show, as part of Lisa's Adventure Club, on Friday, we are giving away another annual National Parks Pass. I don't know who the winner is yet. I can't wait to be able to call them on Friday. That winner could be you, but only if you go to byuradio.org/Lisa and enter for a chance to win. It is 100% proven that you cannot win if you do not enter for a chance to win. That's just it. Maybe that's science. Maybe that's self-explanatory. I don't know. I just know that you need to go to byuradio.org/Lisa, get the annual National Parks Pass, provide memories for yourself, for your family, for your friends, and for your friend's family, if you'd like. You can do that as well. BYURadio.org/Lisa. The Lisa Show is a production of BYU Radio. Remember, you can find everything that you need on the BYU Radio app, where you can listen on demand, or you can also find us on Sirius XM channel 143. If you liked something that you heard, you'd like to hear it again, remember that you can download our podcast wherever you get podcasts, and there is a subscribe button. It says subscribe. Click it. That way you never miss a single moment of The Lisa Show. On tomorrow's Lisa Show, we're going to tell you what you should be aware of as you start to go out again. You're listening to The Lisa Show.